Members, we are ready to begin today. We have quite a few testifiers before us on House File 3421 that was laid over from yesterday. And first on our list today for testifiers, what our goal is here is to get through those individuals first, and then we will take up the amendments. And just a note, I do have room 5 reserved for this evening if we do not get through all the work this morning. So we're going to start with Jim Bartholomew. Welcome, Mr. Bartholomew. If you just state your name for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. In my testimony, I am not going to go through the entire packet. And if Representative Dreiling was here, she'd particularly appreciate that. But I'll just kind of use it as a background. We appreciated the opportunity to serve on the CCRPI task force. It had great members and excellent co-chairs, and was especially well represented by the House. And before I highlight our concerns with the recommendations, I did want to recognize some positive aspects in the task force's report. Some of those are that state expectations in reading and writing are maintained. Students will have more incentives with the science exams. And there's a commitment to providing teachers and schools with additional instructional supports. However, to paraphrase a few of the task force members, the recommendations in House File 3421 represent a shift from a pass-the-course approach to a pass-the-test approach to a pass-the-course approach to determining high school graduation. And unfortunately, this shift was too great, and we were not able to support the task force recommendations, and we'd urge you not to support House File 3421. And I'll try and give you a few good reasons for that. Minnesota historically has relied on a pass-the-course approach to determining high school graduation. In short, this has meant that the state sets standards or expectations, and local districts define student mastery of those standards or expectations. And oftentimes, this has resulted in disparities in expectations. And while there are a lot of factors that go into the results on page 4 of your handout, one of the most important is this diversity in definitions of what is good enough. And I'd like to highlight just one of those, the middle one, is something to think about. Only 27% of the ninth graders in 2008 are going to complete a two-year degree or a four-year degree within 6 years of high school graduation. One in four. Again, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip through the next several pages, but they provide some historical background about how we got to where we are today. But the one message I'd like to leave you with is that Minnesota has recognized the tension between having one level of government, the state, set expectations or standards, and then rely on another level of government, school districts, to determine whether or not students have met those expectations. And this is not intended to be a knock on local control. This is just a recognition that when you have one level of government or anything saying this is where kids need to be, and you leave it up to somebody else to decide if they actually got there, some students are going to be better served in that system than others. Your discussion last Wednesday was a perfect example when you were talking about the differences in grading practices. Even amongst classrooms in the same school, there is a great difference. Imagine students facing that throughout their K-12 experience. We could go to page 7. This is a bit of a summary, again, to reinforce the notion that the definition of what it takes to earn a diploma and being ready and how those differences occur. The numbers on page 9 are not unusual. In fact, they're rather typical. They show the gap between what it takes to earn that diploma and being ready not just for a four-year institution but for a two-year institution. And to clarify from yesterday's conversation, these numbers represent students who enrolled in higher ed within 2 years of graduation. So these are kids that graduated and within a year or two went straight into higher ed, and the remediation is for reading and math. On a statewide basis, urban, suburban, and in greater Minnesota, there are too many kids graduating, getting a diploma, thinking they're ready, when they're not. Rather than building off previous efforts to provide consistency in what students need to know, especially in the critical areas of math and science, and it's often been said, math and science is going to be yesterday's literacy. Math and science in the future is absolutely critical. The task force's reliance on a pass-the-course approach is going to allow the disparities that you've seen here grow. For example, end-of-course test results, counting as only 25% of a course grade, will be too easily overshadowed by other factors like attendance, handing in homework assignments on time, and being attentive in class. These are all very important things, but they don't necessarily reflect whether or not a student adequately knows algebra or biology. And yet they're going to have the potential of overshadowing the end of course exam results. The alignment index is good. It's a proactive move to correct what we've seen in other states, namely grade inflation. Unfortunately, we would have encouraged you yesterday not to adopt the Faust Amendment. Without any meaningful consequences to the alignment index, it's kind of like a teacher saying, I want you to hand in your homework on time every day, and then never really checking to see if students do that. We also have some concerns with some of the changes in yesterday's A6 amendment, including the language, and I haven't had a chance to update from the unofficial engrossment, but in the A6 it was lines 6.6 to 6.11, talking about alternative ways to pass, if you will, or be exempt from having to even take the end of course exams, including some discussion about alternatives based on universal design principles. Frankly, I went back to look at the task force recommendations, and I didn't see that in either the phase one recommendations or the phase two. I think we did have some conversations about that as an aspirational approach, but it was not in the task force recommendations. And frankly, I'd like to hear a little bit more about the rulemaking. Again, that was just after that on 6.15 to 6.20. Again, that was an interesting concept, and I think Representative Mariani highlighted the irony with the earlier conversation the committees had about rulemaking. But if this assessment advisory committee comes up with recommendations, the commissioner of Ed can go straight to rulemaking if she so desires, and that would include the universal design principles. Again, something the task force had some discussion about, but certainly didn't recommend. We'd encourage you to support changes to House File 3421 that would require students to meet state expectations in all four tests, reading, writing, math, and science, to earn a diploma. However, if you're looking for an alternative to that, we'd encourage you to adopt a policy used in over 20 other states. Create two diplomas. One an advanced, and a second could be a basic or a standard diploma. For the advanced diploma, the state would set a grade level score on each of the four tests. And if a student can perform at grade level on each of those tests and meet the expectations laid out by the task force, they'd get the advanced diploma. If they can't hit grade level on all four tests, but they do meet the expectations set by the task force, they'd get the standard diploma. There are at least two main benefits to this approach. One is transparency for students, families, and policymakers. If a student earns the basic diploma and they plan to go on to higher ed, when they get to St. Cloud State, Normandale, wherever, and they're asked to take remedial coursework, it shouldn't be a huge surprise. And again, if you look back at page 9 and the percentages, large numbers of students do. However, if a kid earns an advanced diploma, they should have some assurance that they're on track to being prepared for post-secondary work. The advanced diploma does a couple other things. It also identifies state expectations, which aren't provided in the bill. It allows the state in the future, if you ever choose to raise high school expectations, to do it through the advanced diploma, getting you out of the box that you were last year with a shift from the BSTs to the grad. And finally, the advanced diploma gives you options and links from K-12 to higher ed. For example, down the road, for students who earn the advanced diploma, you could make them eligible for a bump in post-secondary financial aid. If the score is set well enough, you can maybe automatically exempt them from having to take remedial coursework in algebra or biology. The thing about it is it creates options that the current singular diploma doesn't allow.
Mr. Bartholomew, we'd ask that you please
all
wrap
right up. That's about it. I was going to say if you were to adopt a dual diploma or differentiated diploma, we were going to be able to support the original version of House File 3421 prior to yesterday's changes. But without that, on balance, we'd encourage you not to adopt it. We think 3421 is going to make it more difficult to raise overall student achievement and close achievement gaps. Again, relying on a pass-the-course approach in math and science has not... We got where we are today on a pass-the-course approach with the achievement gaps and the disparities, and this will just perpetuate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Next, we will invite up Cecilia Rattel from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Welcome, Ms. Rattel. If you just state your name for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Cecilia Rattel, and I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The document being passed out to you this morning, is the numbers on the left column are based on the delete all amendment from yesterday, just so you're able to follow along what it's talking about. There's also a chart in your packet that is now disregarded because it doesn't apply with the new delete all amendment. So from the beginning of this bill, there's been a few concerns that we would like to address before moving this bill forward. The first thing that we really like about this about the bill is that it separates the reading and the writing scores. We think having both of those pieces is very important. Second thing is keeping the passing score language in place for the reading and writing test. We do think is an important thing to do. And thirdly, it seems like with this delete all amendment, there's a lot of discussions that will be happening to clarify some of the gray areas of this bill. However, there's three major issues that we need to address before moving forward. The first being a cut score put in place for the biology and algebra tests. The second is some conversations about the alignment index and how to standardize the grading of that so that the alignment can be through and through. And thirdly, an end of course exam in geometry, chemistry, and physics we do believe should be at least able to be developed and not have that not language in there. So for the first part, the cut score in biology, to Representative Downey's point from yesterday, where he had asked if a student does get a zero on the test, are they still able to pass? And the issue is that if the end of course exam only counts for 25% of the grade and the rest of the class counts for 75% of the grade, if a student gets 100% on their homework assignments and attending and paying attention, which is great, that gets them to a 75%. Which to most teachers is a C, but it could be rounded to a C plus or a B minus. So the fact is that you could get a zero on the test and pass with a decent grade. So that's one thing that we need to be paying attention to. And so that's the main issue why we really think that a cut score of some passing level needs to be included for the biology and algebra tests. Secondly, to the alignment index, we think at this point the alignment index is insufficient, and there are some major questions that are raised that should be addressed. And if you look at the back side of the handout that was just passed to you, that on the top says provisions that need clarification, I realize that 4.1 was deleted yesterday, but there is some conversations in that part that still discuss the importance of the alignment index and where we need to go. One thing that needs to be addressed is remediation should be happening a lot sooner than 2 or 4 years out. If a student doesn't know the content, that needs to be addressed immediately and not continued to be pushed out for years. Secondly, if a student receives a D in the course and a D on the test, that student would be deemed highly aligned. And that, we think, is an issue because they obviously don't understand the content, and they need some remedial help also before entering college. Or if they graduate and enter the workforce, they never receive that remediation. Thirdly, doesn't apply anymore because that was the part that was taken out. And lastly, we want this alignment index to hold the teachers just as accountable as it does the student and possibly the principal. One possible recommendation that we had made was that if a teacher is grading or a school, depending on, you know, the laws about privacy and that sort of thing, if a teacher or a school is highly misaligned for 3 years, then that school or that teacher's grading, the end of course exam increases to 50%, because we feel like that would put pressure on the teacher to make sure that they're not inflating grades and actually keeping the grades aligned, and give that power of giving grades out to the principal, because then it gives the principal an incentive to be involved in their teacher's grading and encourages more of a conversation to happen. We also feel like it would allow for conversations across the hallway to happen, saying, you know, you're really getting your kids up to speed in whatever area of algebra you want to talk about. You know, what methods are you using? How are you instructing these things? And then those conversations can happen, and it won't be, you know, oh, she's a better teacher than me, or he's better at teaching this part of it, so I don't want to, you know, feel like they're better than me. It's actually having that conversation and saying, what's working for you? So we do think that is a very important piece of the alignment that needs to be addressed. Thirdly, the area that we think really needs to be addressed is the development of the geometry, chemistry, and physics exams. I know it was part of a phase two type of piece for the task force, and the current language in the Lead All says that they cannot, and that is from yesterday's language. It was towards the back. I'm not saying it right offhand, but there was a study done by the National Action Council for Minorities in Engineering, and it quantifies this growing gap. It's called an opportunity gap, and the number of minority students pursuing degrees and careers in science and technology. And what NACME characterizes as the new American dilemma, the report shows that the rates of participation by minority groups has flatlined, and in some cases has actually declined. And this report also articulates a set of call of actions directed to K-12 and higher education, government, and business. And by not beginning to develop these end-of-course exams in these areas, this opportunity gap is going to perpetuate. And instead, I think we need to stop this gap from growing and address it and send a message to our students that these areas are important and should be studied. So some of the specifics that I'll go to now that are in on this sheet that we've been looking at, if you go back to the front page, like I said, we really do like the second one, the 2.18 from yesterday, that the assessment advisory committee is created to determine the specifics of what does it mean to be a passing score, what does it mean to be college and career ready, and, you know, really laying the process out for the teachers. Just so I don't go through all this, I know you guys can all read, so I'll just skip to some of them that we really think are important. Down to 4.25, our interpretation of this, it says that delays the reading and writing requirement for graduation until at least 2 full years before students are required to achieve a passing score on the reading and writing exam to graduate from high school. This puts at least a 2-year moratorium on the current reading and writing test, which likely is closer to 4 years. So our recommendation here is to delete lines 4.25, starting at the word "the" through 4.27. Next one down, the 5.1, it delays the requirement for implementing and impacting students in the state that need help. And by delaying this process, it allows for more students to not be college and career ready and leave Minnesota high schools, but again, our recommendation there is to delete 5.1 to 5.8. Turning to the back, some other things that we still need some more clarification on. 3.9, the provision allows for a student to just take the test and count that as 100% of their grade. This is very concerning because we're wondering what message are we sending to our students. So if you have a student that's very disruptive or not coming to class or whatever and not getting a zero instead in the 75% of the class, but then is able to take the test for 100%, we're sending a very mixed signal to these students and saying, well, you don't have to come to class, you don't have to do any homework, but then you can take this test for 100% of the class. We've discussed the alignment index. And then down at the bottom, a couple of things that aren't addressed in this bill but that we think need some attention is a standardization of the grade system. If we're going to describe this alignment index and tell teachers that they need to be highly aligned in their grading but not give them an actual, you know, percentage line of, okay, well, if your student scores an 88% on the test, what does an 88% mean? Does that mean a B plus, an A minus, or are we not doing pluses and minuses? Are we just doing B's, A's? You know, where are we in that grid? And we already discussed the second one, which was the zero on the test. So with that, I will wrap it up, and thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rattel. For members, the handout that was given by Ms. Rattel is following off of the A6 amendment that was adopted yesterday, not the engrossment that you have today. So just want to make sure of that as you're taking a look at pages and lines that's coming from that. Thank you, Ms. Rattel. Next, we have Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Welcome, Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate the opportunity to offer a few comments. And I'll try to be brief. Yesterday, Dr. Jenny Norland Weaver offered some comments that I think that were reflective of a wide range of AMSD board members. I'd like to thank the task force and the commissioner and her staff. I think they did excellent work, really put together a solid report. It was not an easy process for those of you that were involved. Know that. Want to single out Kent Pakel, Dr. Mattson, and also Julie Schweitzer, who's here today, who also did fantastic work, I think, working on that task force. The AMSD Board of Directors adopted a position in support of the task force report that was developed by the CCRPI working group. We do have a few some concerns about a few of the deviations that are reflected in the legislation before you. And even though one of them was actually removed from the bill yesterday, the provision that allowed a bill back, I'd like to just briefly address that because I have a feeling we haven't maybe heard the end of that issue yet. We're concerned about setting up a system where you would have students that would take a test in post-secondary that is not aligned to Minnesota standards that would then determine whether or not they need remediation. We don't think that is a logical series of events that would be followed. In addition, we think it really raises a larger issue, and I know this is the policy committee, but as you all know, policy and funding are intertwined, inextricably intertwined. And the task force had some discussions about a shared accountability, the importance that when we talk about accountability, it should really be a shared system, students, parents, teachers, schools, and the state, quite frankly. And we think state accountability is lacking somewhat in the proposal before you and in general. When you have a standards-based education system, I think you're really talking about three steps. Number one, the state establishes standards, what we expect our students to know. The state agrees to provide the resources for our school districts to make sure that they're able to offer the courses, et cetera, that necessary so students can meet those standards. Then we hold school districts and teachers accountable for meeting those standards. If that middle step is not there, if schools are not receiving the adequate resources, then we think it's not fair, quite frankly, to have the accountability of schools in effect to the extent that especially would be reflected in a billback scenario. Representative Dabney raised the question yesterday, and I think it was a very legitimate one. If we want to start down this road, then maybe you also want to look at a billback for schools that find that their new teacher candidates out of one of our post-secondary preparation institutions was not prepared, needed staff development, then the bill back should go that way as well. But I would also argue that maybe if we have a year where the basic formula allowance is frozen, causing our class sizes in algebra and biology to skyrocket, then maybe that student should be able to bill back the state if they need a remedial course. We have a situation where since 2003, the state made cuts to our extended time program. And I think some of you are aware that there's a excellent research out of Johns Hopkins University that did a study of the Baltimore Public Schools that showed that two-thirds of the learning gap there was directly attributable to summer learning loss. Yet in Minnesota, we've gone backwards. Our schools are really struggling to try to find a way to do extended day, extended week, and extended year programming. So again, I know this is the policy committee, but I think policy needs to reflect funding. They are intertwined. And so I would, I'll leave it at that. I know you have a full schedule, but thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. Next we have Rick Heller. Then after that, members, we have Roger Aronson will testify. If we can keep Mr. Heller and Mr. Aronson about 5 minutes, we would appreciate that. Welcome, Mr. Heller. If you'd just state your name for the record, and if you could take about 5 minutes, we'd appreciate it.
Yes, hi, Chair. My name is Rick Heller. I got a little handout. I'd like to...
Pages will come up and grab that. If you want to have a seat, you can start your testimony, and the pages will pass that up.
I can only make about 25 copies for expense reasons, so I appreciate it. If anybody else want to look at it, to follow along.
Mr. Heller, if you'd like to begin, and any statements that you'd like to make towards the bill.
Yes, if I may start here on this document, I can't read very well. Appreciate your patience. If we go on some lines, my concern today will be about universal design and universal design principles and universal design documents. This is about the assessment piece as far as being accessible. As I've discussed before, that IDA requires accessibility regarding No Child Left Behind, they merge. I believe if we go to pages or 4.30, 534, 634, those are all areas that talk about the area of the adaptive or computerized assessment. I believe universal design should be in there because the documents that I've handed out, if everybody got them yet, are from the Minnesota Department of Education on the first page that is there. Talks about universal design documents. That letter is dated September 2nd, 2008. Talks about how assistive technology helps students access the difficult curriculum. In relationship to this, very far in the back, there's a golden stock or golden paper that talks about an email from Mr. Dirk Matz from Education to Minnesota Department of Education, Director of Research and Assessment. It appears to me, my comprehension of my, as you can see, my notes weren't written very well because I can't write very well either, but it has the appearance that they're going to use Lexiles, which is again a Lexile framework for balancing or creating these tests for Minnesota grad tests. I don't know if this email was circulated among you, but Mr. Newton had received it, as you can see, because he was the one I had presented the questions from one of the last meetings. If I may go back to the next yellow page of the handout I have there, 171, that comes out of the procedural manual assessment, explains universal design, as I noted on that page in the very bottom left-hand corner. Again, I feel that's important. As we go to the next page, these are all right now, technical manual from Minnesota grads, page 28, again marked universal design, and that talks about universal design principles. If Lexile framework is part of it, I think Minnesota rule only has degree of power reading, something you might want to consider about discussion with the department on that. If you go to the next page, the technical manual for Minnesota Title I, II, and III assessments, which is obviously those who are still learning to speak English, and those that are in least restrictive environment or in the mainstream classroom, talks about cognitive disabilities and using principles of universal design. On the same document, page 40, talks about, again, principles of universal design passages. We go to the next page, which is a document from the, the procedure manual, October 30th, 2009, page 7. It talks about how Minnesota has continued to improve universal design principles of all items for development. Just so you know, Lexile's is going to be piloted this year on MCA's line, I guess, and students will be getting those Lexile's. I've tracked students' progress on accessibility regarding core textbooks. Even with error analysis based on map data, which generates a unique identifier for kids, that student could not take that classwork home and study those textbooks, which basically flows into the next arena of college readiness and being motivated to access that important documents if that's one of the things they are required to do for homework. They get less motivated. It's harder for them to access it. That's the end of this I have to share.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Heller. Next, we'll have up Mr. Roger Aronson with the Minnesota Elementary and Secondary School Principals Associations.
Can you even consider amendment or not? It's not in here.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Roger Ernst, and I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association, and it's kind of helpful here when you have the author's file open.
Let me hide this comment about Roger Ernst.
Just a few things that we wanted to add in the mix on the discussion here for you, and as the bill is in its current format. I've spoken to several principals about their opinions on the percentage of the test counting in the end of course grade. And principals are generally supportive of that. And they thought the number from 20 to 25 made sense. And I think that it goes in very well with what their comments are. It goes in very well with what the committee did yesterday in taking out the bill back provision. But they think that this can be very useful, in particularly in schools where there are multiple classrooms, and that we can see if one teacher is doing very well and is aligned, sure, and another one isn't, then that gives us two options. We can either do staff development with that teacher to say, these are some skills you need to do to impart this, or something's wrong with your curriculum, and we need to reevaluate that and repair that. And that sounds good to them. That makes sense to them. And that is something that we should do. We do, and it's out, but, you know, I wrote a little article for the principals the other day that said issues at the legislature are like the monster in a movie. And the monster isn't dead until the lights come on and the credits roll. And the bill back provision, you know, that was taken out yesterday, I want to reinforce that we think that's misguided policy to do that. The goals of this are good goals and effective goals, and we think the committee was right in leaving that out yesterday. I might say one other thing for the committee, and just in the future, and the chair, Mariani, was on the working group. The working group has 20 members on it, and I was kind of doing the math, and I noted that 7 of them are higher ed, and 3 of them are from the departments, and the balance of the mix are from very other places, but there's only one teacher on the task force, and there weren't any principals on it. Maybe that's our fault for not banging the drum a bit that we ought to be on there, but we ought to look at every one of these types of working groups. And I think Jenny Nordland Weaver gave you some good input yesterday, saying that the work was very transparent. Frankly, as I understand it, the work was hard. It was a lot of meetings. It was a lot of work to get people there. And so we do value the work of the task force, but it is important when you look at these lists that there be principals on them and teachers as well. We think this is good work, that it's going in the right direction, and there's a lot of questions to be answered, tests to be done, but we think this can work very well for us, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson. Representative Mariani, we have a series of amendments up here, and I believe you have an A23 amendment.
Sure, I'll move the A23 amendment.
Members, this should be in your stack of new amendments.
Well, Mr. Chair, this amendment stems from a subsequent discussion after yesterday's morning meeting with the Department of Education as we continue to work collegially about moving the bill in a form that is perceived to be workable by all folks. It doesn't capture all the things that we talked about at that meeting, but it is partly representative of this author's intent to continue to work with the department and with others to be able to shape this bill so that there's broad ownership and that there's effective policy that flows from it. So there's several small things here, and the first one on page 7 goes to the issue of misalignment. We had substituted the word correct with the word address. The department pointed out that they want it correctly, that they wanted school districts more than just to address misalignment, persistent misalignment, but actually to correct it. And so we concur, the author concurs with that, and so we're moving that back to the department's original language of correct. And then we had a long discussion about benchmark assessments. As the committee knows, the task force's very strong desire is that each one of these content areas would be supported by benchmark assessments. That the point is that their strong feeling is that an effective measurement system isn't, again, just about measuring, but it's also about bringing value, new value, diagnostic value to the work that teachers perform in the classrooms, and that's what those formative assessments allow them to do. There are some both logistical and later on in Representative Grayling's committee discussions about costs related to mandating that at this point that there be an assessment that lines up with each one of these. I still think that's the way to go, but I want to be sensitive to the realities that we're facing in our state budget. And so what I want to do is move away from the at least two, leave it at benchmark assessments, plural, which then allows us to continue to negotiate and discuss relative to the budget parameters and some of the logistical inhibitors that the department may be facing. And then on page 9, let me see. Oh, this goes into the rulemaking portion, and so we came up with much better language around rulemaking relative to the open-ended test questions, that the issue really here doesn't go to the purposes in rulemaking as much as it goes to the structure and the supports to make that structure work. And then, let me see. Mr. Chair, I believe that's it.
All right, questions from members. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if we could have the department come down and give us their observations on this amendment.
Welcome, Commissioner Segrin. If you want to just state your name for the record and then any testimony that you'd like to give on the A23 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm not the expert on developing open-ended questions, so I am going to ask that Mr. Mattson address that issue. Line 1.3 of the amendment is fine with us. 1.4, we, as Representative Mariani alluded to, we had some discussion yesterday. We wanted to clarify whether we would choose between four assessments, and as he said, it's that you want all. We did talk to him, too, about the fact that we can't afford all, and so there's going to have to be some fiscal discussion about that. There's a number of things swirling around about the development of these tests. So we need to nail down some of those decisions in regard to that. And then in regard to lines 1.5 to 1.8, I'd rather have Mr. Mattson come up and just talk about developing the structure are doing open-ended and what the process is that we do right now. The main concern that we have is that this shouldn't be put into rule, because this is going to postpone the development of our test probably for another year. Because if we have to create rules around this, that's not the usual process that we do. It's usual that you have a very technical process that is like a nationally recognized process to do this development. But I'm going to let Mr. Mattson kind of explain that. And I think we can get to go, but I don't think it should be through rule for some of these things. I think some things are very appropriate for rule that Representative Mariani is talking about, but this is one that we have some concerns about.
Mr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, members, Dirk Mattson with the department. Yes, we do have, appreciate Representative Mariani's attempt to clarify this language. However, I think it's the underlying construct of the language that we still have concerns with. Lines, specifically focusing on lines 27 through 29 on page 9, to bring to a committee and discuss for a year, essentially because the recommendations then are supposed to be done by February of 2011, the format of open-ended items is not going to be a productive process for us. We certainly already are field testing items for our grades 3 through 8. We would use the knowledge we've gained in that to advance that. We essentially need to start building these items yesterday in order to be ready for the rollout of the timeline that's here in the bill. And to have that conversation about the format of an open-ended item, we make statistical and qualitative decisions about the formats of items and their purpose. And the purpose has already been defined as required in this assessment earlier on in bill language. So we don't feel it's a productive conversation. And in fact, as Commissioner Segrin mentioned, we'll delay, with no doubt, the implementation of this. Again, it would be reckless to begin development of those items to find out that the committee recommendations were something otherwise, and then we would have to stop, re-engineer, and go forward again. Minnesota has a long history of doing constructed response items. They're items that match the research and use in the rest of the country, and we believe that this should best be left to the processes that have been in place for over 10 years in developing constructive response items. Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, just very quickly, I'm not insensitive to the time issue, and I am wrestling with that. I think Mr. Mattson is correct that we want to move as quickly as forward as possible and as smartly forward as possible. But I just wanted to correct, I just want to make sure that Mr. Mattson, with the amendment here, we're not addressing the issue of purposes anymore. We're just strictly going to the issue of structure of the open-ended test questions and the supports needed to make that structure happen. So we're backing off of the original language was very broad in terms of getting into discussion that perhaps might not even be appropriately dealt with in rulemaking. I think that's correct. So I just wanted to make sure that was a part of your understanding of the amendment.
Another question, Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment either both for Dr. Mattson and Representative Mariani, but my understanding of how this came to be placed where it is, and I think it is definitely open for discussion, was the relationship between the open-ended format and the short, the scoring timeline, the 72-hour return, and what would that do to what we have in the past perceived as open-ended items. And I think you have spoken to that before, Dr. Mattson, but I think that's where this was moved to the rulemaking section, and I think the author is probably open to further discussion on that. That's
Mr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you, Representative Briner and Representative Mariani, for those clarifications, and I appreciate that. I would still suggest that the format of the open-ended item, my staff spend conference calls you would never want to be on talking about how many pixels from the left-hand side the stem begins and how many pica over after the decimal for the number that shows up there. I mean, these are the format of the questions is done on usability issues. We do intensive research on that, so while I recognize the issue of it being not about their purpose and the response time, certainly if they're done on computer, we have been designing in our 3-8 math program ready for implementation next year that all items, even constructed response, are going to be scored on computer. We will no longer use human scoring for those, and that's our intent going forward for all of our computerized tests.
All right, members, the A23 amendment is before us, and we will vote on that. All those in favor of the A23 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Members, next, I will move the A24 amendment. And the pages are going to pass that out, the A24 amendment. As they're passing out, I will describe this. I share some concerns, as other members do, with the biology and algebra tests of saying that a student could get a zero, in essence, on that and still be able to pass the course. And so what the amendment does, and you'll see it as it's being passed out, it just says that the student must receive a passing score in biology and algebra, and that it links that, that the commissioner must establish what would be considered a passing score through the same recognized methodology that they are doing with the reading and writing. So it would be under the same methodology that they are using to then create a passing score under reading and writing to also do that for algebra and for biology. For the exams, yes. In order to clarify that, as you get the A24 amendment, there is one little technical to make sure that we are defining that it is under the exams. I will make that oral, incorporate that oral change.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Moran.
While that's being passed out, perhaps we can ask folks from the task force who are present to comment on this issue.
Absolutely. So one oral incorporation then to this would be on line 1.3 of the amendment, delete in and insert the, and then on line 1.4 after the word algebra, insert exams. So it would read, all general education students must receive passing scores on the biology and algebra exams to graduate.
And Mr. Chair, while
Representative Mariani.
Well, folks, when past Mr. Pacal, one of the co-chairs can come forward, I think I know what he's going to say. I would say that, you know, part of what we're trying to do in terms of the big scheme here, or that scheme, but the design here, was to have a new balance, if you will, a new approach here that really did a powerful alignment between the exams themselves and the grading system here. And this seems to me that we're going right back to essentially our present design that we've expressed a lot of discomfort with, which in many ways totally disregards the other measures of valid measures of success in the classroom, and zero is right back to using the single measure of an exam. But perhaps Mr. Pacal can further elaborate on that.
Mr. Pacal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Kent Pacal. I am the Executive Director of the College Readiness Consortium at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I want to suggest that this is an issue on which we spent hours and hours, and a huge one, and I know you appreciate it from the classroom perspective. I will say that for the vast majority of educators, both secondary and post-secondary in the task force, if this provision is in place, it loses their support for the entire package. And the rationale that Representative Mariani just articulated is the reason. If you add a cut score to an end-of-course exam, the premise was all the powerful work that will happen around alignment, around the coherence of that algebra and that biology course, is really for naught, because in the end, we're back with a single measure on a standardized assessment. There is the statistical possibility that a student would completely tank on the exam and pass the course. However, having also been a classroom teacher, I'll tell you, I think if we can't trust our teachers to trust the other 75% of the grade, treat it with an integrity that doesn't pass the kid who completely fails the exam, we have bigger problems than our accountability system. It ultimately does come down to trusting our teachers, who not only have to assess the math and the science, but actually have to teach it. So this system does create the possibility. I will tell you that the likelihood that a student who completely bombs the assessment is going to have all of the other things that go into that percentage of the grade in line is very small. The other point is that alignment index is going to create a very productive tension in those high schools, and teachers that are passing students who bomb the exam are going to be really helping to put their high school out of misalignment. So I would suggest that this was an issue. I know other members of the task force, our colleague in the business partnership, pushed repeatedly for this issue. So we really grappled with it. And in the end, it came down to the fact that if this is in place, let's not pretend that we're putting in place a system where the incentive really is passing the course. We have a cut score. And let's call it what it is. And that's what our teachers and kids are going to pay attention to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions from members? Representative Norton.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pickell, that raises a question, and perhaps it's in here and I've just forgotten, so I'm just going to ask. Is the student required to take the test? And what if they show up and sit and don't answer any questions, put their name on the test and don't answer it, and just don't fill it out? Is there a provision for that?
Mr. Pickell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the student would be required to take the exam unless they are taking one of the other authorized alternative routes, like an advanced placement or the ACT exam. The student would therefore need to sit for the exam. I mean, what you just described does happen today occasionally with the grad. So it is a possibility, but they need to sit for the exam or one of the other alternative routes to earn a diploma.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And two questions, if I could. The first is, why does the absence of a cut score automatically drive incentives to alignment, and the presence of a cut score of necessity means that there would not be incentives towards alignment? I mean, how does a cut score somehow eliminate the incentive towards alignment if we're still measuring alignment?
Mr. Pickell.
Mr. Chair and members, I want to be very careful that I'm trying to represent as best I can the task force discussions and not a personal opinion here, though obviously we all blur in that. It wouldn't entirely suck all the alignment energy out of this proposal. That's obviously clear. But the opinion of most of the educators who had very strong views on this was that if there is a cut score, ultimately, that is going to be the driver of accountability. And it's that driver of accountability that's going to get the attention of the kids and the teachers. And that if there is going to be an absolute cut score on a standardized test, people are and should treat it like they currently treat the grad, which is that they're going to focus very, very intently on getting kids over that bar. And the larger multiple measures emphasis. That's the whole point of this algebra and biology strategy, was that you're converging an external test score that should be a rigorous assessment tied to our very demanding standards in math and biology, is a significant, 25% would be nation leading, so a significant percentage of the grade, but not the sole determinant. And if there's a cut score that's the sole determinant, the perception was essentially then we are in a system that's quite similar to the current one that we have now.
Follow-up, Representative Downing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let me just pose a scenario based on my observations of the real lives of my kids in school and their friends. We learned last year that one of the challenges of interpreting the high-stakes end of high school math test was that it was never given in a high-stakes environment, and we were told that you could experience perhaps even in the teens percentage variation on test results for students who were taking a test under the auspices of high stakes as compared to just taking it because they were supposed to take it. And so I can easily envision a scenario where somebody has performed quite well during the course of the year, and with an end of exam test being 25% of your grade, you know what? Taking a little bit of a cruiser on the exam, knowing you're going to pass the class, knowing you're going to graduate, knowing that the test doesn't really stand for anything meaningful in the end. And so my observation is that we wouldn't be able to measure alignment as well with students who aren't taking a high-stakes test where there's some kind of cut score, and that you aren't really ever going to know whether you're improving, because the data will always be cloudy. We'll never know for sure whether collectively in Minnesota we just had an unmotivated year or whether we're really improving. So I guess maybe challenge the assumption that somehow we're gonna get better alignment and better measurable results. It seems to me it's the reverse, that a cut score produces all of that for us, not somehow as a detriment to it.
Mr. Pacal, would you like to respond?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey. I think a guiding principle of this discussion, I would suggest, and you're articulating it extremely well, is that all of us can find a potential scenario of a hypothetical kid that breaks down the logic of the system. There's a kid who will coast on the exam, or there's a kid who won't be able to do it. And so that's possible. That is absolutely possible. The premise that the task force spent 9 months working toward was, as I mentioned, number one, where we were looking at multiple measures, and that a standardized cut score has a very strong risk for some kids of either a false positive or a false negative. That where that student scores on that standardized test may not be predictive of his or her readiness for success in college or careers. And so that when you look at standardized test outcomes, some of the kids who don't hit that cut score actually would have gone on and done well at a technical college, community college, two-year college, or in the workplace. Some kids who do hit that cut score actually go on and don't succeed. One of the things that's fascinating that's coming out is actually the ACT and the SAT, a different test, are correlated only with success in credit-bearing course in the first year. And actually, there's recent research that finds that success on the ACT and SAT are negatively correlated. Kids who do really well on them in high school do somewhat worse in college completion than kids who do somewhat worse in high school on the SAT and the ACT. Because the knowledge and skills for success actually in college are not necessarily captured on a standardized test. So those were the two guiding principles, Representative Downey, that we really grappled with: multiple measures and the limits of a standardized test. And we still have a standardized test with a hard cut score in the system in language arts. And so this was an effort to experiment and also put into practice those two principles in high school algebra and biology. But I would concur, the scenario that you're articulating obviously could happen. The design of the system would be intended, however, is based on the assumption that won't happen for the vast majority of kids.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not really sure that I even have a question anymore, but this is all so complicated. When I look at what we have now evolved to, I think a lot of it is so positive in theory in here. But I, like Representative Downey, want to steer my line of questioning to the students. You're a teacher in a classroom of 35 kids. You're at the beginning of the year, and you lay out your syllabus. And you say, so much of your grade is dependent on this, so much of your grade is dependent on this, so much of your grade is... And if you have kids like mine, which are just very average, middle-of-the-road, mainstream-type kids, and there's about 3,000 of those in the school that I send my kids to. They're in their mind calculating, okay, I do have to do that, but I really don't have to do that, and I can do this, and then I do really well on tests, so I do that, and I've got my C and then or B. Now, so what you, if you're the teacher in this classroom, and so then back to the old math tests, the one test, if you don't pass it, you go to remediation and you get time and time and time again. The kids that I talk to, and I'm talking about now the mainstream, they just look at me and say that nobody is ever going to take, now, and they're sitting in like cafeterias and classrooms and stuff taking these tests with all their friends. They come home and say, there is no way in the world you're ever going to get anybody to care about that test unless that test means something. So, given those two dynamics of what do you tell the students in the classroom now that you have this end of course with no cut score, and what we just tried of having a cut score on one test for everybody and then relinquishing that point of view, what do you as a teacher tell the student about that test that motivates them to do their best?
Mr. Pacal.
Through you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich. there were two issues on which I would have popped up because of the last 9 months that we spent. One is the issue of a cut score in algebra and biology. The second is lowering the percentage. Lowering the percentage, which you talked about yesterday and which you had a thoughtful discussion of, really runs that risk. In our estimation, 25% is robust enough that it is going to give that teacher the ammunition he or she needs to make sure that student understands you are very unlikely to pass this course if you don't do well on that assessment. The phenomenon of grade inflation is not going to be simplistically solved by the state publishing the issue of alignment, but I think that's going to be a powerful driver that, frankly, is going to help that teacher do what he or she might have wanted to do for a very long time and say, I can't bump you up because we're now in a new era and our high school can't afford to inflate these grades at all, and you're going to have to actually succeed on this test or retake the course or complete a credit recovery process. Again, as I suggested to Representative Downey's question, you're articulating a scenario that could happen. We hope we've set up a system that on the whole will raise achievement for most kids and not result in very many of those instances in which you do have a student deciding not to take the test seriously because of the structure of the accountability system. So the percentage is part of the fix. The percentage is a de facto cut score for the vast majority of kids. That's why that percentage we feel is really critical.
Follow-up, Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. When we say not take it seriously, I just mean not trying their best, you know, not coming with their A game, really thinking that this is really something meaningful in my life and it's really going to affect what's going to, and we're talking teenage kids here, it's not going to affect what happens to me tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. I'll be brief. Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, the other point I would just note is our charge from the commissioner was very clear to build a system that was relentlessly focused on college and career readiness. And I would simply add, as somebody who now spends all day on a university campus, the mental approach to how hard do I work on this, this, and this is very much how college students live. And so in some ways, this system does approximate a lot of the ways what grading will look like in higher education, where it's a hybrid of a test and participation and showing up, but one that has got real stakes to it. Unlike for a long time our junior and senior high schools in which performance didn't matter, and I would concur as Jim Bartholomew described a while ago to you, none of us want to go back to the era in which we didn't have high expectations for kids.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great discussion. And since this amendment does include the commissioner, could we have someone from the Department of Education step up and speak to this particular issue as well? Thank you.
Welcome, Commissioner Segrin.
I am Alice Segrin, of Education. I forget to do that all the time. Mr. Chair and members, I had a lot of debate within my mind about whether we do cut scores or whether we do the 25%. And I think I articulated why I went with the work group's recommendation on the 25%. I felt that, as I said before, the 25% is representative of much more robust standards than we've had in the past. That 25% of a course now is going to really drive, hopefully, the teaching and with the alignment index. I don't think I would have supported it without an alignment process. I still would encourage you, and I'll make my plug again, that we keep in some consequences for the schools. I think that we need to have a total package of expectations for everyone. But that's why I ultimately looked at the 25% as being very robust. With the alignment process that will be set in place, I think that I feel comfortable with that. And we've also got the cut score for the reading and the writing that will continue. I would recommend that we stay with the work group, but certainly I know that there's, you know, deep feelings about doing a cut score too, and I respect that too. There are pros and cons, as Representative Mariani said, about all of this, and the discussion went on for a long time. So because of that, that's why I also thought that we needed to have some consequences to comfort those who may have supported the cut score, to say, look, we are going to move forward with this in a very serious manner, and we're not going to let anyone, you know, potentially game the system, but we want to have, you know, a strong system as we go forward.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, members, it's wonderful to be able to concur with the department and work both closely but also to move forward in some very tough issues from balancing the same kind of important issues that we're balancing out here today. So what you heard is both the task force and the department has struggled with this issue, and the design before you is a design that they think best works, and it's a design that really needs to be looked at as a whole design here, and not just isolating this one issue. And so, members, I would ask you not to accept this amendment.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the author. Is there anything in this legislation, working off of some of the scenarios that Representative Dietrich spun out, that would prevent me as a classroom teacher from requiring a certain score on the end of course exam as part of my criteria for my grading and passage of a student?
Representative Mariani.
I'm not sure. I don't believe that there is, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
I've read the bill, actually, and I don't see anything that stops me from a teacher as saying, we've got two papers and a set of quizzes, and there's some activities, and maybe because it's biology, there's a lab thing, you got to cut up some dead critter. And then at the end, you've got this test that's 25% of my grade, of your grade by state law, and if you want an A in this class, you need to score on that, and if you want a B, you need to have at least this, as well as these other things.
Ms. Chair, that's logical to me in terms of how the 75-25% is structured. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Probably already been discussed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just a comment, I guess. You know, I think that you have to have 25%, and I really support that. Because, you know, we had all this discussion about cut scores before, and the potential problems with the cut score. And with the 25%, you can have multiple measures of learning that I think provide more opportunities for students. And so, you know, I really do support the idea. But if we water the 25% down, then I think we have lost much of the value. Then I'd go back to the cut score. So that's just my personal opinion.
Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick comments. One, a reminder to members that there's still a consequence in the legislation. If school districts are highly misaligned, their staff development resources are required to go toward correcting that misalignment. And in this day of professional learning communities, that's a serious consequence. There's a lot of other uses for those staff development dollars. So there is a consequence. Secondly, I'd just like to say, I oppose this amendment because it undermines the heart of the end of course approach to graduation requirements. So I would just say, let's give the end of course approach a chance to work before we try to constrain it in ways that might undermine the very process.
Representative Demmer. Christy, I thought you were. We're sorry. You look. Well, you look so engaged. Representative Downey. With that, we will move the A24 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Representative Swales, would you like to move the A16 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that amendment. I am missing it from my packet, Mr. Chair, so if a page could bring me one. Oh, thank you. A16. Mr. Chair, what I would like to do is
just take a moment and explain what I would like this bill to represent. This was offered to me by the Business Partnership, and one of the things that I really liked about it and am intrigued by is that it does provide two tiers of diplomas. And if everybody would think back to what I've championed ever since I was here earlier, starting 3 years ago, I have worked very hard on policy related to gifted and talented students. And I'd just for a moment like to kind of tell you a little bit about my own children. I rarely talk about my family, but I think this illustrates where I'm at with this particular bill. My daughter, Anne, was always a high flyer. She was in ballet. She would dance 25 to 30 hours a week and maintained a straight A average and graduated high school as a member of National Honor Society. She had the gold sash for being in the top 25 students of 600 in her class. She had the gold tassel for National Honor Society. She went on to college and graduated magna cum laude, or laude, from the university that she attended. Always a high flyer. My son, on the other hand, when he was in elementary school, was identified as special ed. He had a reading disability. He had a speech difficulty. And so it took him several years to grow out of his special ed status. And in the meantime, he discovered in middle school that he was charming. And that became one of his, the thing that he really tried to develop was his charm. And it meant that he was just an average student, and it wasn't until he was a senior in high school that a couple of teachers had really inspired him, and grades became important to him. I remember the comment, "You know, Mom, if I study, I do well on tests," which was like an amazing thing. So at the beginning of his senior year, he decided that he really wanted the silver sash, which meant that he had a 3.0, and he worked really hard and finally brought his GPA up to a 3.0, but was devastated at graduation. They did not give him a silver sash because they stopped considering GPA after the second term or second quarter of his senior year. But he went on to college, and in college he became a high flyer, and now he is working for Boston Scientific in London. And out of the 16 countries that have Boston Scientific in the European Union, he is the number one person for number of clients, and the work that he does there is really exciting. Now, I simply offer that because I have worked with the high flyers for the majority of my career. I know that these students who take AP classes, these students who are in IB, these students who are like my daughter who danced 30 hours a week and maintained a 4.0, I know that these students are achieving at the high end. And just like in college, on her diploma, it says magna cum laude. It would really be quite an impressive thing for these families to say, my student has an advanced diploma. Now, the standard diploma, I think, you know, Mr. Bartholomew from the Business Partnership can certainly make a statement as to why a standard diploma should be something that is available to students as well. But I would urge members to consider the advanced diploma language. And also, you have a document in front of you that lists the 21 states that do offer advanced diplomas. You can see that they range from every region of our nation all the way to Hawaii. And I would really urge you to at least consider this language. And that's the amendment.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the spirit in which Representative Swales offers the amendment. And I think storytelling is a good way to be able to convey its relevancy. However, I would say several things. One is that neither the task force nor the commissioner recommended this approach. But more importantly, what we're aiming for here members, and I guess maybe I'm being a little conservative here, but what we're aiming for here is really a one diploma, high school diploma in the state of Minnesota that is rigorous, that expects much, that's relevant, that has high quality, and that we want every student to strive for that. We want every school and school district to structure themselves in such a way as to be able to deliver that consistently, that high level of rigor consistently across the board with all their students. I would note that in terms of post-secondary, there's nothing right now that bars post-secondary from doing from exploring precisely where your student has been, what kind of experiences a student has participated in. If they're an honor student, what rank and class they're at, whether they've participated in IB, AP, and obviously things beyond the academic ground. And so that transparency is already apparent for post-secondary. Post-secondary aggressively pursues that information, requests that information of its applicants. I don't think we need to turn and twist, if you will, our consistent expectation of a uniform, high-quality high school diploma in order to meet post-secondary's desire to be able to get access to that further information of where a student has been relative to their academic pursuit. So while I appreciate the spirit of the amendment, I would ask members not to accept it.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along lines with what Representative Mariani has said, just two quick thoughts. One, independently of the merits of the proposal, I would say this proposal is of such a magnitude it ought to be a bill in its own right. If we're going to go in the direction of differentiated diploma, it deserves a broad consideration. A lot of testifiers look at other states' experience, some research and data before we would move this proposal forward. Independently of that, offered in this context, when what we're trying to do is make our current graduation requirements more uniform and more meaningful, I think it bespeaks skepticism of the very process we're engaged in. In other words, what we're doing isn't quite good enough, so we have to do something else on top of that, and that's stamp a diploma, you know, at a level. So I think it does undermine our process, and we need to watch this process move forward and see its results before we pursue this differentiation.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually like the idea of a second diploma if it's done the right way. And so I think that I agree with Representative Brinert that, you know, we need to flush this out a little bit more and look at this a little bit more and spend a little bit more time working on this, because there are a way that we could do that I would be very supportive of that, and so I would hope that we don't give up on this idea if it doesn't pass, but that we continue to work on this, because I think that a lot of good could come out of something like this.
All right, Representative Swales has moved the A16 amendment. All those in favor of the A16 amendment, please say aye. Those opposed, same sign?
No.
The motion does not prevail. Members, we are at that time. We tried to get through 5 testifiers and 9 amendments in our time here, and we're not successful. We still have about 6 amendments left. We have room 5 reserved at 6:30 p.m. tonight to be able to move this, and I think we can get done within an hour, or at least we can shoot for that. Fairly optimistic. 6:30 tonight in room 5. So with that, we are at recess.
Second time all year.
All right, members, we will reconvene the K-12 Policy Committee and take up House File 3421. And Representative Mariani, I believe that you have a... you have an A25 amendment, and would you like to do that first?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I do, and actually, let me just explain very quickly what's the last. I'm following you, someone turn off the cell phone. another discussion with the department after the recess, and had a very good discussion about some of the concerns that were raised in the morning hearing. And so I think the Section 25 amendment, and it also will have a bearing on some of the amendments.
Someone has just dropped it.
Yes, cell phones.
Yeah, someone has a cell phone. Please turn it off.
I just do it mine so we can look it out. So it may have a bearing on some of the amendments that are in the folder. So I think it would be a good way to sort of quickly get us, relatively quickly get us to where I think the committee wants to get to.
Do you want to walk us through then the amendment itself? Okay, members, we're going to walk through the A25 amendment, and there are two technical corrections to the amendment that you do not have that Lisa will go through when you're done walking through it. So Lisa Larson is going to go through the technical corrections, and Representative Mariani will incorporate those.
Mr. Chairman, members, on the document H3421A25, page 1, line 10, after the word requirements, insert in. And page 1, line 27, after the word and, insert.
So I will incorporate that into I'll try to do this concisely quickly. The first part of the amendment, amounts 1.3 through 1.7, get at the issue of defining what we mean by college and career readiness. And as you recall, in my earlier draft, I basically kind of put a little marker under that provision, that section heading is rulemaking. It's not an appropriate function for rulemaking. But in my discussion with the department subsequently, what they're basically forwarded is the definition that the P20 Council has developed. And it's a major charge of that council to work on the environment of people until secondary. And it's also now a creature of the state, of legislation. In other words, it's a creature that we own, and whose work represents high-quality Minnesota work of all sorts of stakeholders in Minnesota. And so I think it's a good definition that allows us to move forward with that particular concern that I have in reading that, the definition. And then on lines 1.8 through 1.9, this goes to the issue of transfer students to Minnesota, and it had to do with how do we deal with the fact that some of them may have in the past something similar, or actually we're saying this language, having met requirements that are of equal or greater rigor. This is not what the department brought forward, so we don't want to comment on this, but I think it gets us closer to the true intent. You know, we have high rigor in the re-graduating students here from other states. We want to make sure they're meeting those same standards of rigor. And then, the other major piece is I keep moving.
Who does? I'm surprised that got
there. Is on line. Line 21, so this will be line 12 of the amendment, we'll be deleting line 21 and then deleting line 22. And this has to do with the alternative methods. The language, I am still a little nervous about incorporating a go-ahead on the alternative methods, the meeting, and of course the equivalent. Because I do think that there's some important things that need to be handed out in terms of a consistent, uniform measure of policies, alternative methods. And so what I'm doing with this language is basically not allowing the commission to move ahead with implementing those alternative methods until he or she is authorized by law to do so. And later on in the amendment, I make it real clear that this advisory group will vet through what those alternative methods could look like. And then, on line 115 of the amendment, this came from the department and suggested to insert the, I'm sorry, let me just check it really quickly. In the administration, the regular intervals of administration of the language arts task event be done in the most common high school standard. So the department can speak to that, and that evidently has some cost factors for us and some logistical issues that make it easier for us to do, for the department to do this work. The other major, my 117-18, is just being very clear and consistent that we're talking about early versus college and career readiness. And then 119 of the amendment. And members, this goes to the issue that the committee struggled with earlier in regards to the sanctions for highly misaligned schools. And if you remember, the highly misaligned is, it's pretty evident that, you're really persistently misaligned there. The tension here is that we're trying to come up with some kind of a strong enough sanction, if you will, to stop the highly misaligned outcome. And we had rejected as a committee the whole concept of charging back to post-secondary. And I actually think wisely, for a lot of reasons I won't get into now because it'll just, it's not an issue before us. But nonetheless, there is a sense from the department as well as from other members and other stakeholders that there ought to be a sanction even above the sanction that's still in here when you have this persistent highly misaligned. So the concept here, and this is going to be phased in two or three sections here, but here's the concept, that when you're highly misaligned, then that school will have to revert to a 50% end of course framework. I'm sorry, 50% end of course exam weighting in the end of course framework. And then there'll be a way to back off of that. If you get back a line, then you can revert back to the 25%. And let me just say that one of the principles that both the commissioner and I and our task force members consistently laid out is that when it comes to the issues of states, sanctions, supports, that those should be really spread out pretty evenly among students, teachers, the schools. Admittedly, when you're running into, when you're pushing to a 50% under course exam, I would argue that raises the stakes a little bit more for the student. But nonetheless, the way this is supposed to work is that there's a real consequence for the culture of that school. So if Representative Downing is a high inflation teacher, and he's teaching algebra and persists in that consistently, so therefore, I know you wouldn't ever do this, but therefore throws our school off of, into a misalignment. And Representative Murdoch is also teaching algebra on that course. Representative Murdoch now has to deal with the 50% sanction in his classes, because the sanction goes to the school. Yeah, see, that's exactly what we want to have happen, is you get a stern look over at the representative body. The point here is that there's a cultural kind of pressure that's building, an environmental, organizational pressure to peer pressure, really, you know, calling on the administrator of that school to have something even more overrepresented Downey relative to his relationship with the rest of the school, including his other colleagues. So we think this might work. I think the department is good with this. I think they also feel that this could be effective. So that's what that that language of line 119 through 124 will do, and then we'll come back a little bit later with the third part of that. And then on line 25 to 26 of the amendment, that gets us back to the issue of transferring students. But obviously, before we're talking about language arts, now we're talking about algebra and biology. So it's the same language that I proposed in the language arts. Turn the page and amend it on 2.1. On 2.1, that also speaks to the alternative methods relative to algebra and biology. And again, it's neutral language if authorized by law. And then we continue the amendment on 2.5 to 2.9. That's the third part of that, what happens when you're consistently disaligned. And so we move over to 50%, and this speaks about how you can then may again count students at SAM score for the 25% once you get back in alignment. And then, it's the end of the day, folks, so and the amendment on 2.10 this basically just says that the advisory committee serves without compensation. And then on line 2.14 of the amendment, this reintroduces the notion of a notation on a student's transcript of the student's level of college and career readiness in the three, or rather the four, the reading, algebra, and biology content areas. This was consistent with the task force desire to have differentiated levels of accomplishment indicated somewhere in the student records. Then members on line 214. Yeah. I'm sorry, I just did that. Then the other substantive change gets us into the advisory committee itself. And so if you look from lines 220 forward, what we did then with this language is we took those elements that I originally had crafted in a rulemaking direction. So the issues are the administrative structure, criteria, process for implementing the state level students' appeals process, calculating the alignment index, and then defining misaligned and highly misaligned. What we're doing with this is we're telling advisory committee to vet those issues through an issue recommendation forward. And so part of what the department was concerned with, and I was struggling with that too, is having a rulemaking process that to take us beyond a reasonable period of time for us to properly implement the work before us. I would contend, members, that this issue, and I'd love to hear from the department on this because I haven't had a chance to talk to them about this, but the issue of the appeals, the alignment index, and the definition, we've got some time here to be able to carefully work that out. I don't think that needs to all be developed right now, as everything else is being developed. I think we have a little bit of time just because of the way that, a student's appeal isn't going to happen, for a number of years. The alignment designation of alignment isn't going to happen for a number of years. So I'd like to hear the department's take on that. And then on lines 232 of the amendment, basically says the commissioner shall not implement these elements. So again, the alternatives, the appeals process, the alignment index, and the definition of misaligned, highly misaligned, without receiving legislative authority to do so. So the thinking is that we will come back after the advisory committee has carefully vetted all these issues through, recommended those to the commissioner, and that we would either act, that we would act one way or another as a legislative body on the issues of law. So members, I'm sorry that I did that kind of raggedly. I'm kind of trying to move relatively quickly here. I'm trying to be real sensitive to some of the testimony that we heard this morning from the departments, just some of the logistical issues that the original language raised. And I'm really thankful that they came forward with some practical ideas that allowed me to chew off with a little bit more on the issue and suggest this amendment for you today. So with that,
questions from members? Yes. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if the department, it sounds like this is the department's amendment. And if the department could come forward, I'd like to understand a number of the elements here.
So from the department, I'd like to come forward and offer any statements on the amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, before they do, or as they do, let me just say, this is not the department's amendment. It's my amendment, but obviously it's heavily influenced by discussion. I want the department to discuss.
Commissioner Seagram.
Mr. Chair, how about if I just throw out questions and whoever wants to answer them at the table or in the audience can go for it.
All right.
Thinking back to my childhood, and when my family moved from Wisconsin to Illinois, I'm looking at the language on 1-8 and 1-9 of the A-25 amendment, and then again we get to the same issue on 1-25 and 26. I'm thinking back to when my family moved from Wisconsin to Illinois. It was the summer between my sister's junior and senior year in high school. And the scenario that is being set up here is if she had passed all of the tests required for graduation in Wisconsin and came to Illinois as a senior, she might be required now to retake courses, retake tests, simply because the family moved, nothing having to do with her or her performance or the like. And I guess the first question is that the intent? And I'll let members decide if that's fair. And the second question is, how do you judge, what is the criteria to be used to determine whether other states' tests are of equal or greater rigor? Or as it says on 1-9, equal or great rigor?
Mr. Chair, let me take a first crack.
Representative Mariani.
I know the commissioner wants to continue to address because this is actually my language. What you're pointing out is that there may be a logistical issue, as perhaps even a fairness issue. The principle here, however, I have to say, but I think it's okay for the committee to struggle with this and come out with a different answer. We're going to have a different answer from the commissioner. I think the issue here is that Minnesota is setting a direction here allowed on rigor. Our level, the level of rigor of our standards. And our expectation is that students that come through our system, our graduates certified through our system, meet those standards. And the tricky thing here is how do we do that when, in fact, we've got people coming from other states? And I think it's absolutely appropriate for us to struggle with, so on perhaps one extreme, the answer to that, because every state's different. Not every state even has high school requirements, graduation requirements around these content areas. And so one posture for you to take is, well, that may well be, but, there still are products out of our system, even if they've only been here a year, and these are the standards that we stand for in Minnesota, and we'll work to get those students through those standards. Obviously, when you're getting to an end-of-course requirement, it's a little bit trickier because it's more than just taking a test. On the other, perhaps, extreme, I would say, we'll look for a proxy close enough that aligns as closely as possible with the standards that we're shooting for. I think the commissioner has a relatively simple way to address this, and I don't mean simple by putting it down. I'm just saying that it's, you know, no. I mean it's a straightforward way, which is to identify the federal accountability exam, which then exists in any of the other states. And I think it's perfectly appropriate for the committee to say, here's the choice that we want to make. I'm offering the choice that if the issue here is that we are looking for consistent products out of our students, regardless of where they started from, that our standards are this, and if we're going to look at alternatives, including recognizing other states' certification, they should meet our standards. But I'll look at the commissioner.
Commissioner Seagrave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the reasons that you cited, Representative Dabney, we took more of the simple approach and said that if we were going to, because courses vary, all of these things, it would be, I think the districts want to have something that is pretty straightforward to figure out if a student moves in from another state, and the simplest thing to do would be to assure themselves that they've passed an equivalent state exam, and the exam that was closest would be the one that we use for No Child Left Behind. All the states do it, so that was the simplest method, so that a superintendent or a principal wouldn't have to worry about, okay, now go back and try to figure out what would the equivalent or higher rigor be in all these courses, and as you said, then potentially have to make the student take a course over if the principal deemed that it wasn't the high rigor. So we were trying to make it as straightforward, as simple as possible. And that has been the practice, as I understand it, that has been used for a while now for, when this happens. So that's why we just stuck with that. And I leave it up to you all. But I think it might, as your example would be, I think it's going to present more decision-making elements for a principal or a superintendent when a student comes in as it's written. But that's the reason we did it the way we did it.
Follow-up, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, maybe I'm missing it, but I don't see any criteria in here. Representative Mariani, you are talking about some tests and standards, and this is how we already do it, and this will be simple. But all I see here is, if we, through some process that isn't defined in statute whatsoever, decide that the state you took the test in isn't good enough, then we're going to make sure that you don't graduate on time.
Well,
and I just don't see any criteria here. And
Mr. Manson,
missing it?
Representative Mariani or Mr. Manson?
Mr. Chair and members of Duke Manson and the department, I'll try and answer it again. It truly is an attempt to be to simulate or replicate the language that's currently being used for the grad. So it's not an attempt to add increased hoops, etc. So as the commissioner mentioned, the original language that was with the reading and writing test was to say if they are proficient on their federal accountability test, we'll take that. There's a specific reason for that. As the commissioner said, every state gives a federal accountability test in reading and language arts. And so if you don't have, half the states don't have a graduation test. So if we just said they had to pass a graduation test, then half the states would be out. The other reason is for equal rigor is specific to whatever we determine is going to be Algebra 2 or advanced high school algebra, whatever name finally comes out of that. You don't want it to be that, hey, I passed this lower level of algebra, and we say, well, that's good enough. Our expectation is if it wasn't at this higher level of algebra, then you do need to participate in that. And that'd be a requirement of a student, even if we weren't talking about testing, just talking about credits earned. So I hope that's of help.
Follow-up, Representative Dabney.
Well, let me state, if I may, to share two things and then move on to another topic. My understanding from speaking with staff is that there is some language that's directive as it applies to the reading and writing test in the bill, but there's no similar parallel language when it comes to the biology and algebra.
Yeah.
So at least my reading comprehension is maybe it would pass, maybe it wouldn't, but it's not terrible. I would certainly be more comfortable if the criteria was in the bill. I'd also be more comfortable if we set sort of some sort of time frame. If the student moved in as a junior and had 2 years to adjust, I think that's a different question than the student who moves in as a senior and moves in the middle of the senior year, and we look at them and say, I don't know, I guess you don't get to graduate. I just have concerns there. I will skip my snarky comment related to the 50% and asking whether the commissioner is just going to take over assigning grades in biology and algebra for the entire state and move on instead to concern that this committee voted this morning not to have a differentiated diploma. And I'm troubled that the committee took a position, we voted, and it's back again. And I know we get to do that, but I'm offended.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, I take it that Mr. Abbey is referring to the 50% in the, and I guess I would only offer that what we voted earlier today was a uniform application, a differential diploma across every school district and every student that we graduate from our high schools. The issue here is, the reality here is that the 50%, unless we really have an incredibly bad grade inflation issue happening uniformly across the state, is something that's going to happen in a pretty rare circumstance. A small percentage of circumstances. And the point of the whole kind of the whole design of this approach is that we never get to that by the kind of interventions, the kind of lead time, you know, you have to be highly misaligned. It's got to be happening for 2 years. You've got this clear, you know, 3 year period of time ahead of time where you're developing the alignment index. You're stepping into redirecting staff development dollars if you're not able to stop a persistent problem. I'm not saying that will result in absolutely no misalignment, but my guess is that it's going to result in a very rare instance of that. And so therefore, the intent here isn't to create a differentiated diploma, not at all. The intent here is to create the conditions under which, after persistent, even after interventions, after persistent behavior, if you will, on the part of a school and graders, that there be a strong way in which to change that behavior. And perhaps this isn't the best one. I think probably it goes, we earlier, you know, rejected the charge back to the schools as the strong sanctions, and I agree with that. So I guess perhaps the real bigger issue here is, you know, does the committee feel that it needs to have sort of this tougher set of sanctions, and if so, you know, what should it be, if it is this one or if it isn't the charge back issue. But Mr. Chair, said that me, I also voted against the differentiated diploma approach. It's not the intent that this produce that outcome.
Mr. Chair, with Representative Downey. Representative Downey. The concern I have about differentiation is not with the 50%.
No.
That's the concern about the... Yeah, sorry, that's the concern with the commissioner.
I don't like to cut anyone off, but I was thinking that you were referring to lines 214 through 216 of the...
With the notation on the transcripts. And I, you know, you're the chair. I wanted to be respectful and not interrupt.
Well, I thought I had
your best for eyes. I'm just concerned that we're just going in through the back door to the very thing that we voted against this morning.
represent Mariani or Commissioner Segrin if you'd like to.
I'll take a pause here and then I'll.
Mr. Chair, I hope that we've gotten a clarification on a student that's moving in from another state. I don't know if you've gotten a clarification on that yet. I think the intent was that if any student came in from another state and they had already taken an equivalent course and passed it, that they would be given credit for it, especially someone, as your example was, if they came in as a senior, you know, that they wouldn't have to start taking a lot of courses over. And there's been a process that's been in place, and perhaps what we can do is see, or maybe some superintendents and districts, what's been happening and how that's been working, and then kind of get back to you on that. But it's not the intent to make this, you know, something that is unfair to either the student coming in from another state or be unfair, you know, to the equivalent of this, what the work that is being done for our kids here in this state. In regard to your snarky comment, this 50% was not my recommendation, so I want to make it clear. And there's also a tradition. I know I'm not in the House anymore, but there is a tradition that you don't question people's motives about why they do things. And we've had a really robust discussion about how we want to handle these things. And so I really don't appreciate you questioning my motives about why something is or is not in. I know that this is a passionate discussion, but and I know you don't have to treat me as a legislator one-to-one, because I'm not that anymore. But I hope that we can maybe all just be a little bit more respectful and express our concerns without those comments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Commissioner, now that my motives have been questioned, I did not question your motives. I raised a concern about a provision in the amendment that I thought closely parallels a provision in an amendment offered and rejected this morning. That is not questioning motives. That's raising concerns about outcomes.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, we should probably all take a deep breath. It's been a long day, and this is an emotional issue because these are our kids. We want a better system, and, you know, this is complicated stuff. And, it's one of those things where, you know, you attempt one thing, and then sort of these other kind of unintended consequences happen. But let me just get back to the issue that Representative Dabney raised, which I believe is on 2.16. Is that right? Yes. And this goes to the issue of the retention on student transfer. Let me just say that the task force in their report on page 15 of the report thought that it would be wise to have notation of performance levels that indicate progress toward college and career readiness, such as advanced readiness, college and career readiness on track and off track. And I guess I see your point, and I guess is that dangerously close enough to a two-diploma approach? I had not thought of it from that point of view. I was just picking up their desire to have some, you know, level of notation on a uniform diploma. And actually, I don't even pick this SUS diploma. Students transcript, so it avoids getting us into the diploma discussion. And so that's really the intention here. I think both the department and I, you know, we talked about this earlier, and it seemed like, a consistent thing to do with what the task force had stepped forward with, and that as long as we keep dealing with the transcript, that it's going to fail relative to our higher actions.
All right, we're going to move on. Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few things. I too have concern that echoes what Representative Dabney indicated on the student transferring, and it sounds like we're going to work on that language. I just would like to be sure that there's task force representation as we work on that language, because I know there was long discussion over this exception, and I think that there should be some input from
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, and I apologize for members. I did not want this to be a sloppy process. And I told us to represent the Dabney. Oh, we're out of here in an hour, hour and a half. There may be a simple way to deal with that issue about the transfer. And I think that the department, I really did not mean the word simple as a footnote. I mean, I thought it was a real, you know, kind of, you know, direct way to deal with it, which is to replicate our current behavior, our current practice. And it would be simple enough for us to do this evening, if that's what you so desire. If now we can continue to work on it between now and the next couple of weeks.
Representative Briner.
Mr. Chair, I won't belabor that point, Representative Mariani. I just wanted to affirm that I had a concern there, too. My next concern is in the Section 119 through all the way down to 124, where we get to the 50%. And my question is, does that movement to a 50% requirement apply only in the subject area in which the school is highly misaligned? This language does not indicate that. And that, to me, is a serious consideration if we're going to do that. And my recommendation would be that it would apply in the subject area in which the school was highly misaligned, not in all end-of-course requirements.
Sensing from the nods that yes, it would just be.
Just to get that on the record, is that the
thank you. One
yep,
more
Representative
point, Mr. Chair. Then on to lines 214 to 16, the issue of the recording on the transcript. I'm not necessarily against this, but my consideration would be that there's a process that we've already, that we have it, that those differentiations have to be developed. So I think we have to think about when it is they would go on the transcript and what role the advisory committee might have in saying, we now have these down enough to hold the student accountable in a public manner. So I think that that needs more more detailing in terms of a timeline and the role of the advisory committee in the process. And then I would be more comfortable with it moving forward, because we'd have evidence that the data supports the decision. Does that make sense, Commissioner and Representative Marion?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Seeger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Briner, yes, I think that makes sense. What I'm thinking about, and I'm thinking out loud, is the direction is, you know, that we are to set the college and career ready level, and, you know, whatever other, and we have to set the levels for the accountability for No Child Left Behind, or ESEA is probably what's going to be called, go back to that. So probably after we do all that, and there's got to be all the validity and stuff, then your point is well made, then we would move forward with that. So we either get to do some kind of an effective date to into the future, or something that we would work out that would be clear with language, and that this will not go on a transcript until that is all decided.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, what you have, my commitment is similar to the other concern if we're willing to move forward this evening, we'll work on language to make that happen.
Representative Downey, to that point.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make sure I'm clear on that. I've learned that all I can vote on is the bill and the language I have before me. And this is actually, frankly, if I'm going to vote for this, this is probably the one thing that inches me over the 50.001% favorable line. So if there's a possibility that this would somehow be changed or delayed or altered, I'd prefer that we gain some clarity for this committee's the sake of our votes here before we vote. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani.
As soon as possible, I think
I'm here at the testifiers table, but perhaps if the representatives that spoke up and worked with our council, we might be able to quickly address some language here. And even if it's, because you know, when you do things quick, you know, there's always a tendency to do it but a little sloppy, but at least if the intent is there, the direction is there, it's clear, we can always be out there if it's sloppy.
Representative, I would appreciate that, and I don't need to bother.
It's in the area of the transcript annotation, is that what you're...
The agreement that...
Or all of the areas that they've been discussing?
Mr. Chair, the one that seems to be where there's perhaps some agreement to actually move forward with some modified language is in the area of the transcripts.
Transcripts, okay.
That's most important to me. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's appropriate for this committee to ask to have the time to do that.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it seems like we're hitting the same sections. One of the things that I'd like to have considered is we have a large number of students who are going to USDESDA schools overseas, and whether they're military, we've got, you know, people from Medtronic, 3M, with their kids overseas and bringing them back. And how do we do this with the, you know, compare it to other states? Can that also be done? And I don't know if the Department of Defense schools or State Department schools overseas apply. But we've got an ever-increasing number of students that are coming back to Minnesota from overseas positions. And the other thing, back to that 214, 216 area, you know, following up with what Representative Downey said, I think we also have to look at what college and what career. You know, when you start putting an assessment as to whether they're ready for a career, you know, what career is it? And so I see the commissioner pointing there. But my understanding is that the Secretary of Education is looking for having all kids college ready. That's sort of the new focus. And I would suggest that we delete the career and just focus on being college ready. Maybe be a step ahead of the Department of Education.
Representative Mariani or Commissioner Segrin?
Commissioner? Mr. Chair, Representative Newton, if you look on lines 1-3 to 1-7, and I wanted to address that with you all. The T20 partnership, for over a period of about 2 years under the direction of President Brunitz when he was the chair of the T20 partnership, created a working group where higher education people, K-12 folks, business people came together to define a definition of college and career. And you have before you the definition that that we want to put in place so that that will then kind of put a framework around what we do as far as setting those levels. The one thing I do want to draw your attention to, though, that I think needs to be changed, the verbiage was changed slightly from the P20 partnership's language, and there are two things. On lines 1-4, it used to say means the knowledge and skills that a high school graduate needs to do either credit-bearing work. And the reason, and instead it's been changed to undertake, the reason for the needs to do, and I talked with Mr. McKell because, you know, we've both been engaged in this work, the committee felt that while there are nuances of words, the committee wanted to really say that they needed to do, not just undertake or try, but to really do this credit-bearing coursework. So my suggestion would be to go back to that P20 language. The other thing, if you go to line 1.6 through 1.7, and offers clear the original language in the P20 was pathways, not opportunities, and pathways was a definite word that was selected because the committee wanted to say that you should be having the opportunity to build a pathway or a career ladder, if you will, take a ladder of education so that you can continue, and they wanted to say pathways, not opportunities. So they wanted to be clear that you could start maybe in a technical program, but then after you acquire that language, that may allow you to then, you know, go back to school for more. So I would just suggest that we, you know, clarify that. But that's the language is what has been developed over a period of a couple of years. So that would be my suggestion there.
Thank you.
Representative Brenner?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to suggest that perhaps Mr. Pickell would like to comment on that, the definition of that phrase, just because it's part of what he does every day, college and career readiness as a term, and what is its preciseness, you know, in terms of creating a cutoff or a measure.
Welcome, Mr. Pickell.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Briner, I'll be brief because you've heard a lot from me, but you're right. This is not only what I've been doing at the university, but was focused on both as a high school teacher and administrator. And the thing that's happening right now, and it's really actually fascinating, is that the knowledge and skills for success in post-secondary education are converging with the knowledge and skills for success in high-skill careers. That's not every job. It's a job that meets those three criteria that Commissioner Segrin talked about, a job that you can support a family on, a job that is increasing in the economy, and a job that has a pathway to advancement within the field. So that's kind of the technical definition of a good job. And the knowledge and skills for success in those jobs increasingly look like the knowledge and skills for success in post-secondary education. The ACT, which gives the college entrance test that 70% of Minnesota high school graduates take every year, has also for decades given its Work Keys assessment, which helps businesses assess the math and literacy skills of employees. They've started doing correlations between the two when they look at the actual success of the levels of successful employees and then the levels of successful post-secondary students, and they're finding them almost identical, which is a fascinating change. So the math and language arts skills for success in high-skill careers and high-skill employment, higher education, are converging. A final example of that, Larry Letecki, who's president of one of our community colleges, Century College in White Bear Lake, every year asks his English faculty, because it's a liberal arts faculty, to do a reading level assessment on the manual that they use in the first credit-bearing automotive technology course. And he does this as a sort of check on what level of reading you need to succeed in their credit-bearing automotive tech. And once again this year, I was out last month to talk with Larry about some of the work we're doing. And once again, the reading level you need to succeed in automotive tech at Century College is college-level reading. You're not going to be able to read that manual if you can't read at the college level. And so the bifurcation between the technical and the academic worlds, at least in reading and math, is increasingly blurred.
Thank you, Mr. Pickell. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great minds travel in the same circles, and so my questions are also on lines 213 to 216. And it really is probably more of a comment that I'd like a quick response to, I guess, and hopefully be rather quick. This seems to me that what we're trying to do is exactly the same thing as teachers are doing when they assign grades for classes, and also what the ACT test is doing when students take that. And so it seems to me that indicating on a transcript the student's level of college and career readiness is exactly what we're already doing when we assign grades. And how is this going to be different than that, and why do we need to have something different when we're already doing it? It seems to me that we're being very repetitive.
Would you like to answer?
So,
Representative Ryan.
I understand Representative Faust's comment. There are a couple of them. One is that the grading itself allows you to have the grading itself de facto does that sort of valuing or rating of readiness. And then the other point is that your performance at measuring devices like the ACT or the ACT to do that. Obviously, with the latter part, not all kids are taking this test.
but obviously the first part of all kids are getting grades. And I guess all I can tell you is that the task force and its recommendations thought that in addition to the framework that they laid out, that they saw some value in being able to have some kind of performance designation. And again, you know, our folks here have that attach itself to the transcript as opposed to attach itself to the diploma. I can't give you all the arguments and reasons for it. I guess I'll stop there. And I guess part of that has to do with how we do interpret grades and what grades mean.
This is the test. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have so many comments, but I think just the first one is going to capture the essence of I think that a conversation that's been going on for a couple of days here, and I think it's in my opinion, at least from this member's point of view, very positive. And the reason why, and I'm going to talking about that moving to a 50% of the students' overall coursework. I think you've probably heard me say a couple of times is what we're trying to do in all of this, I think, is change some kids and teachers and administrative behaviors. And so, moving to this 50% when something is not succeeding, when something is not going right, to me at least, is sending a message that they're going to do something different in that classroom. They're going to probably, and it's going to probably equate to time, and it might mean learning goes slower, which is at least according to me, what a lot of those kids' issues are. Or they're going to do different type of learning to make sure that those kids are successful, because now this assessment is going to be 50% of their grade. Those are the two key things that I have been kind of searching for in this is, you know, what different process are we going to have, and how are we going to address the issue of how you're going to spend your time differently? So I think that I personally really like this, the 50% thing. In regards to Representative Newton's comment about which college, which career, I think those are really good questions, but we have to remember that right now, at least the last time I looked, only 30% of our kids even finish a four-year college. So I think that we have to be real careful that we're not, whatever we're doing isn't just tailored to 30% of the kids. And that's why I really do appreciate, I'm going to go back to this 50% thing, because I think that that is actually then changing people's behaviors, creating, I think, making some the people who need to be responsible for the success in charge of the success or increase the success. The other thing that I would like you to address or somebody to address, so I'm not clear yet, but are our report cards going to go to aligned or misaligned and that reported publicly? Because at least according to me, that's the true definition of accountability, is how you publicly convey that information. And then my last comment, Representative Mariani, is on the transcript piece. I somewhat agree with Representative Faust. That's what grades do. That's what the designation of AP, IB, right on the transcript do. And, you know, the other thing is that I'm just going to be brutally honest here. My kids are right in this college-bound age. All their friends, like I said earlier, very mainstream. We're dealing with the thousands at this point. None of them have had much trouble getting into college. They're still letting most of them in. Some of them who haven't even hardly been there at school for quite, and have really struggled. And so I don't see that the bar is like way up there yet that we have to start designating on their transcript which ones have really exceeded. I think that the Yales and Princetons and Harvards are going to be able to differentiate that pretty well by their transcript already. And I think the, you know, I won't go any further. I don't want to
name names here. I think the other schools have a different philosophy, and that is let them in, and we'll weed them out the first year. And that's what I see happening. So I think that the whole transcript thing, I think that that just might be, at this point at least, maybe a little bit premature, unless we want to just give somebody a gold star. And if that's the case, then do it. Give them a different color diploma. Let them put that up on their wall and put that in their office for the rest of their life, and they can say they did that. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Representative Mariani. Representative Petrick raised an intriguing question about the report card. We're not referencing the report card, but I was checking for that in statutes here. It sort of does kind of beg that, but I think probably if we were to move forward with something that we would should at least consider as part of looking at the report card statutes and our expectation of how we use them and report that out. But right now, the language is silent.
Okay. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did not want our commissioner to feel that her request to consider new language in lines 1.5 or 1.7 was ignored. And I'm wondering if it would be appropriate, Mr. Chair Mariani, to suggest that we do apply the two words do on page or on 1.5 in place of undertake, and on 1.7 rather than opportunities, that we change that word to pathways. And I think that the work done by the P20 partnership, where they've given thoughtful discussion to that language, I do think that it's more specific.
Mr. Chair.
And I just want to intercept that we are creating an amendment that would encompass all of those changes that we've been talking about here, including Representative Downey's, including the commissioner. So if we could hold off just a few minutes, we would have one that would take care of everything. Okay. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to Representative Dietrich's question on the report card, we haven't included it in the language of the bill. However, it is in the recommendation of the task force. If you're on page 15 of the task force report, it does say that school and district results should be released over the web and to the media, similar to the methods currently used for reporting results on MCA2 and GRAD assessments. So that was considered by the task force, and I think it's totally appropriate to consider how we might put that language into the bill. You know, your point's well taken. Then I just wanted to comment briefly on this issue of the transcript, and I'll say honestly that I'm not a huge fan of it, but I'm going to guess, I don't know, but I think it might be a critical issue for the business partnership and maybe the chamber. I don't know, but in deference to those who might consider that this would be a way of reflecting a more complete evidence of the rigor of our requirements, and also give an opportunity to reflect on the great inflation issue, because you, with reading and writing, it's not actually, you won't have the alignment index as you do, as we will with algebra and biology, but we would be able to see if a student scored, let's say they scored at the basic level or whatever, and they have all A's in reading and composition. I mean, I'm making an extreme example, but that I think that those who hold we need a further evidence or reflection for reflecting that achievement, might say that. And my perspective is I just would want to be certain that the data we're using warrants public reporting before we begin to hold the individual student accountable for it. So I would certainly want a timeline, and I would want the professional input of the advisory committee. But personally, I don't hold it in high value. But I think maybe the chamber would like to speak to that. So,
Ms. Patel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Reinhart. We do like the language that is in the amendment 2.14 through 2.16, because it clarifies for not only the student what their grade means, and is it a way for the teacher to, you know, interact with that student, but also for the parent to really know, is my student receiving this grade that represents what they, the work they did, and what they really deserve, not just an inflated grade. As far as our intention for it being anything that looks anything like a dual diploma, to get to Representative Dabney's point, absolutely not. That's not what the chamber's position is on this. But we do like it because we think it brings it down to scale. So even if a school maybe does have this highly misaligned, but this is one of the students that's grades are highly aligned, that student doesn't fall into this broader category. So that's a clarification that we like. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rizzo. All right, with that, members, I'm going to move an oral amendment to the A25 amendment, and Ms. Larson is going to go through that, and that encompasses a lot of the changes that people have spoke of. So please listen attentively, I guess, as Ms. Larson tries to share that.
Mr. Chairman, members, in the H3421A25 document, please mark the following. On page 1, line 5, delete, undertake, and insert do. On page 1, line 7, delete opportunities and insert pathways. On page 1, line 9, delete grade and insert greater. On page 1, line 10, before graduation, insert high school and delete requirements. And delete the rest of line 10 and line 11 and insert quotes, federal accountability exam, and that would be in quotes. On page 1, line 21, after grade, insert in algebra or biology, comma, as applicable. On page 2, line 5.
Sergeant, would you please repeat the last one?
I'm sorry. On page 1, line 21, after grade, insert in algebra or biology, comma, as applicable. Page 2, line 5, after students, insert algebra or biology. And after score, insert comma as applicable, comma. And page 2, line 16, after subdivision, insert after the levels have been established through a professionally recognized methodology.
Could you repeat that statement?
Mr. Chairman, members, on page 2, line 16, after subdivision, insert after the levels have been established through a professionally recognized methodology.
And that is it. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure we're technically okay here. I don't think we adopted my amendment. So the language is attached by support. I could easily do this by just incorporating those into my motion at this point, and we can vote on it. I just want to make sure effectively we're doing this right.
Sounds good. So I will withdraw my motion, and then you can incorporate those into the A25 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I will incorporate those into my amendment. And then I do want to point out one other thing that the Commissioner and I were chatting briefly. Also on the amendment, on line 120 of the amendment. I think this was just an error moving quickly, but the word 3 on line 120 should be 2. I don't think the point is that we want highly misalignment for 3 years before we act, that we're looking at 2 years. And then on line 1.23, the same thing. So I would incorporate also to my amendment to strike the word 3 in both of those lines and insert the word 2.
Any further discussion from members? Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And well, first, I just want to compliment my colleagues. I think this has been really excellent discussion for all of the time we've been spending on this. And just to ask a question to make sure that I'm understanding kind of the point we've been discussing in great detail, lines 2.14 through 1.6, with the language that has just been suggested for incorporation. Is the college and career readiness designation to be developed, and I looked again through Representative Breinert's suggestion at page 15 of the report, to performance on the exam or on the course where we're doing end of course work or incorporating an exam as part of the course? And I guess to whoever wants to answer that.
Mr. Matson.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Department, no, that those performance levels are specific to the exam. This would be exam only performance levels, not the incorporation of the content, because obviously that content is very diverse across all schools.
Okay, thank you. That's. I assume that was the answer, but I've learned maybe you should just ask to be clear, so thank you.
Representative Dupke.
I had one question, and I don't know that this is to Ms. Larson or to Representative Downey, but on the transcript, I know this was a break or go or break moment for Representative Downey on the transcripts, and I wanted to know if the language that was after the subdivision that says after the levels have been established through a professionally recognized methodology, is that the change that you were happy with?
Representative Downey.
Representative Dupke, actually, I don't have a preference for the language. Actually, I'd prefer there not to be any qualifiers or for there not to be any qualifiers or conditions. I simply wanted to have some language so that I knew what we were voting on as compared to kind of an implicit agreement that some work would be done. So actually, I would defer to maybe Representative Breinert or others who raised the issue as compared to myself.
Representative Breinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually asked for more restrictions, but I'm willing to accept this as a compromise in favor of Representative Downey moving to the 50.00 whatever that we might motivate him to support the bill. I guess my basic position is that qualifying language, what it does is what ought to happen anyway, and that's that we would be certain that the measures were valid and reliable before we would print them on a student's transcript. We wouldn't want to simply, in the first round where we're beginning to differentiate those designations, assign them publicly to students until we were certain over time, whatever the period is, a two-year period of following the measures to see that they have validity and reliability. So this does that. It doesn't limit the application to the judgment of the advisory committee, which I had earlier recommended, but I'm willing to make that compromise in favor of Representative Downey's movement.
Any other further discussion from members? Okay, we have before us then Representative Mariani's 825 amendment as amended. Just because it's incorporated. Have the 825 amendment before us. Christina is making copies of it. Do you want to wait to vote on it until then, or are we okay with voting? Okay. All those in favor of the 825 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. All right. Representative Dabney, are you wanting to move the 826 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to try to have conversations with the department. We'll see how it goes. So I'd like to hold that at this time until I'm able to work more with Dr. Mattson, which I'll get up and do now. Thank you.
Representative Faust, you are not moving the 822 amendment?
That is correct.
Representative Downey, the 818 amendment?
The
822. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Everyone's doing the same paper shuffle that I am. I'll give folks a minute to grab the amendment. 822.
Members, the A18 amendment is what we're on.
Okay. Thank you.
18.
And this would be to the delete all amendment, the UEH 3421-1, I believe, is what this is referencing to. I don't think this section changed in the author's amendment that we just passed. And actually, I have a series of amendments, members, that attempt to take what I might loosely call just a little bit of squishiness in my mind out of some of the alternative routes to passage. And this amendment here, what jumped out at me is that we're tying the commissioner's hands a little bit in terms of setting the thresholds by which we would define the proficient, not proficient, what would now appear on the transcripts at some point. And maybe I would just, if the commissioner is busy looking, I think maybe with the change that we just made, that some of the basis for this amendment is not as important to me nor maybe to the commissioner, but my sense is that we were asking the commissioner to set thresholds in a certain prescribed way, and that we wouldn't leave the department enough flexibility. And I see she's busy working on something else, so rather than ask her to come up, maybe I'll just withdraw my amendment and assume that what we just defined in the author's amendment will take care of it.
All right, so Representative Downey withdraws the A18 amendment. Representative Downey, would you like to move the A19 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would move the A19 amendment, and let me make sure I get the right section here. So this, too, is to the original bill, or the delete all of the original bill, on page 9.
It's been removed from the bill.
Actually, the section 4 in its entirety would be stricken there.
I believe it's already. Oh, is it still in? Okay.
It's still in. I was trying to track, and I think it's still in. So it's line 9.3 through line 9.5 is essentially what we'd be striking here with this amendment. And the basis for this amendment is that just as there is grade inflation and other variables in high school person transferring from one school to another, assuming that somebody who took a PSEO class or, you know, some online thing or something would, generate a grade of C, and just assume that meant proficiency to the extent that we'd be wanting here in Minnesota. I'm just saying there's enough variables and enough great inflation on college courses as well that we would strike this provision. So I just offer that amendment for discussion.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd speak against the A-19 amendment. If the goal is to see if students are college ready, I don't think there's a better test than having kids take college courses and pass them to show that they're college ready.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just ask Representative Downey to consider that these recommendations come under the purview of the Assessment Advisory Committee to review and recommend them. We have not actually we've given this list because the list came from the task force in our 9 months of considerations as possible ways students could have alternative pathways. And we restricted that further. We just didn't say they would be alternative pathways. We've said that the Assessment Advisory Committee will review them and recommend on them. So I think you have some checks in place here and that for a high standard. And I would just ask you to consider that in terms of your comments.
Any further discussion on the A-19?
No.
Representative Mariani.
Mr.
Chair,
I want to echo comments here, both in terms of continuing to forward the task force recommendations, but putting a bit of a break and making sure that it's more carefully vetted through the advisory committee. And I guess at this point, I would trust the advisory committee to do a good job with this and any of the other alternatives that are before us.
All right, all those in favor of the A-19 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same side?
No.
The A-19 is not passed.
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney.
If it is to your pleasure, we could take up the A-26 amendment.
It is very pleasing. A-26. Representative Dabney to the A-26 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know what? Before I was elected, my predecessor said one of the stranger dynamics on the floor is after there's a big dust-up of some sort, said you never want to be actually in the position Representative Martin was today, you never want to be the next bill because you're never sure whether the dust-up is going to mean everybody's going to keep feeding in a, you know, a chart-feeding frenzy, or if everybody's going to go and step back and let things roll. So we're in a similar dynamic. I would like to move the A-26 amendment to be before the committee with the following oral amendment. On page 1, line 6, delete the word 2 and insert the word 3. And on page 1, line 11, delete the word 2 and insert the word 3. And what this does, members, is if these tests are given in a computerized format, oh, my apologies, Mr. Chair, in a computerized format, the department has to return the results to the school within 3 days. And I think this will significantly increase the value of the testing to teachers, parents, and students. I've worked with Mr. Mattson today, and I think it's fair to say that he is in agreement with this amendment at this time.
And the nod is on record, Mr. Mattson. any questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A-26 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same side. Motion prevails. Representative Downey, would you like to move the A-20 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would move the A-20 amendment. It is similar to the previous one, hopefully a little more substantive in members' minds so it doesn't go down like the last one did, but it would strike lines 9.6 through 9.11 and in the original bill. And the grounds for that, I think, are a little more substantive here. In line 9.7, it says that the advisory committee must develop recommendations on integrating universal design principles. And I guess, absent my lack of understanding of what universal design principles really are and how complex they are. I just looked at the mandate that follows thereafter, that we would do that, that the advisory committee must do that in a way that improves access, more accurately understands what students know and can do, and provide educators with more valid inferences about student achievement levels. That seems like an incredibly large mission statement, if you will, and I don't know enough about universal design to somehow edit this down to a more reasonable scope, but my thought was that as I looked at it and read it, not knowing universal design, boy, we could come up with almost anything that would allow somebody an alternative way to graduate, and I was just concerned about the looseness of it, number one, and the scope of what we were asking the advisory committee to come up with.
Representative Dar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to speak in strong support of this amendment, Representative Downey. This just appears to me to be, I think the idea is good, but I think it's very technical, and I think we have technical people in the department. This is a science, the science of coming up with assessments, and I think to have an advisory committee kind of try to take the place of the experts that we, hopefully experts that we have hired at the department, kind of is overstepping a little bit. I think we're micromanaging here, and I really believe we need to let the experts within the department do their job in putting these assessments together, fulfilling the principles and the ideas that we have in this. So I'd speak in strong favor, Mr. Chair, of this particular amendment.
Any other questions or comments from members? Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, and I get what Representative Weber and Representative Downey are struggling with. In my conversations with the department, and I, like you, if you ask me to go real deep on describing universal design principles, it's not going to get very deep. But in my discussion with the department, what they said is that, in fact, that their staff apply these principles and vet these principles out. And then the conversation with Dr. Mattson got to the point where I didn't understand it anymore. However, I guess my real intent here, and originally when we had this developed, it was, I guess, even more problematic because that led to an automatic rulemaking provision, and so we backed off of that. And I get the point about must develop recommendations. I think that potentially, given how complex this is, could create a whole bunch of problems we don't want to create with the group. I guess my intent really had more to do with making sure that a conversation in this group involves talking through some of those issues. And I just wanted us to be able to send a directive to the advisory group to do that. And in particular, insofar as universal design principles can lead to things like improving access, to learning and assessment for students, and also cost-effective ways to do that. I probably would not want to sit on that group, but I nonetheless wanted to make sure that there was a healthy conversation happening between that advisory group and the technical expertise on staff at MDE to make sure that we're not really having the tail wagging the dog here, so that the values really come from the advisory group and the technicians that apply that. And so I'm struggling with sort of finding softer language other than must develop recommendations. And I would prefer to go that route as opposed to just striking the whole provision out. And I'm not coming up with anything at this point. Shall I consider may develop, the universal legislative so I guess I would ask I would move to amend the amendment by striking the word must and insert may. Does that work, Ms. Larson? Technically anywhere?
Mr. Chair, actually, my amendment actually strikes all of that language, so I think we have to vote. We have to vote on my amendment.
I think we have to vote on Representative Downey's first, and then
Yeah, Representative, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
The Representative Mariani could amend the A20 amendment, striking lines 1-3 through 1-5.
Oh.
And on page 9, line 7, delete the word must and either insert the word may, or you could insert may consider developing. But that's to you.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I try to pride myself in making sure the members get their motions voted on. So I prefer to vote on Representative Downey's amendment. And I'll live with the outcome of that. And if it goes down, then I will be moving the language that I just suggested.
All right. With that, Representative Downey moves the A20 amendment. Those in favor of the A20 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The amendment does not pass. Okay. Representative Mariani.
Yeah, I would like to move on my 9.7. I'm not sure I'm doing this right relative to, I think this helps. 9.7 of the UEH 3421-1 engrossment to strike the word must and insert may.
Questions from members? All right. Those in favor of Representative Mariani's oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. All right, members, that is it for the amendments. So we have before us then House File 3421 as amendment. Would you like to renew your motion?
Let me just say that before I do that, and I know everyone wants to go, but let me just say that I really do value that this legislature owning a new approach here, and it's probably on in terms of the different way to do assessments about people. I think this is a move in the right direction. I think there's been a real strong alignment of interest across the board. Obviously, not everyone's on board, but that is rarely the case, but everyone is. I think there's broad support for this approach. I will continue to engage with folks, seeing this move forward so that we continue to shape this in a way that at the end we've got an assessment system that can be powerfully delivered for our students. So, you have my word on that, and my door is open to listen to any members. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll give you my motion to that. Also, by my number?
3421.
As a member of the recommended past. The first of the Committee on Finance for the recommendation that will be needed to be
All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails, and House 3421 is recommended pass. Can I get a motion to accept the minutes of our March 17th meeting? Representative Loon moves the minutes of our March 17th meeting. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, members, just very quick. We're not scheduling any meetings of the committee next week. We actually still have some important work to do, even though it's not official work insofar as official means voting on things that will move forward in law. But there continue to be big things that are hanging around, like Common Core standards and how this legislature is going to understand those issues and what we're going to do, if anything, relative to our state moving forward with Common Core. And of course, you know, we're not going to be in session most likely until after this Common Core are forwarded. I want us to have a healthy discussion about how Minnesota owns the decision around Common Core, if in fact the legislature is not allowed to do that.
There are also a couple other possible informational hearings on some issues and bills that we were not able to hear this year, but that are nonetheless important for us to be informed about. I suspect we won't be able to do that until after our break. So next week, we'll be conceding our time for the Finance Committee to be able to do as well. So all that for us, stay posted, and we'll let you know as soon as we see.
And with that, members, we are adjourned.